Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I think it's safe to say that Andrew Carroll's book, Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History, began with a remarkable encounter between Robert Todd Lincoln and Edwin Booth, the brother of John Wilkes Booth. And we will hear that story and many other fascinating stories from Andrew this hour of the program. Andrew is the author, editor of several New York Times bestsellers, including War Letters, Letters of a Nation, and Behind the Lines, War Letters, which inspired the highly acclaimed PBS documentary of the same name. He edited Operation Homecoming, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Homefront, in the words of U.S. troops and their families. The book inspired the film Operation Homecoming. He founded the Legacy Project, an all-volunteer initiative honoring veterans and active duty troops by preserving their wartime correspondence. He's contributed to many, many publications. And Here Is Where is part of a larger campaign, although this is a pretty large campaign itself, to seek out and preserve historic sites all over the country. He's got cabinet after cabinet after cabinet of details on his journey, which took several years, and he traveled to all 50 states, and he traveled by kayak and plane and car and you name it, to find these important parts of American history that tell a larger story in many ways that we just don't know about. He's going to be in Madison this Thursday, is the 20th, right, of June, because he's going to be part of a special John Muir historical plaque dedication, which is taking place, and John Muir is mentioned in the book. This dedication is something you're invited to, and we'll tell you about it as we talk this hour. For you to join our conversation, I think we'll have a few phone calls this hour because there may be little bits of history that you want to let Andrew know about, or he already knows about it, and he can give you more details about something that's piqued your curiosity. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Andrew, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's so great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I really love the book. It's just filled with, it's so fascinating what you came up with. And let's start with the story, which I think is safe to say got you rolling on all of this, this encounter between Abraham Lincoln's son and John Wilkes Booth's brother at a train station. Is that what got this whole thing rolling?
Absolutely. That's what sparked this whole initiative to find these unmarked but significant sites. I, for the past 15 years, I've been working on an effort to preserve war letters from all different conflicts in American history. And I would come across these little nuggets here and there of these larger stories. I'm like, I really want to know more about that. And one of the stories I came across was a young man, this is during the Civil War, was standing at the Jersey Exchange, which is just outside of Manhattan, and either he was jostled or he slipped, and he fell between the train and the passenger platform. The conductor didn't see him, and he signaled for the train to go ahead. And so as the train was just about to roll out of the station, and this young man would have been crushed under its wheels, another bystander rushed over, grabbed him pretty much by the back of his lapels and yanked him to safety. And as you indicated, the man who fell was Robert Todd Lincoln, obviously the son of the president. The man who grabbed him was Edwin Booth, older brother of John Wilkes. And when I first read this, I thought, it must be apocryphal. It just sounds too good to be true.
Right.
And you know, maybe they were at the same train station at the same time, and then people embellished it, or, you know, or maybe, you know, Robert did fall and someone else saved him, and people thought it would be more interesting if it was Edwin Booth. But sure enough, I came across a letter that Robert Todd himself wrote describing the incident just second by second and what happened. And what's great about these little anecdotes is that as you're kind of digging into one, you catch the gleam of another nugget. And I was sort of curious about the Booth brothers. I realized I knew very little about them. And as I was researching Edwin and John Wilkes, the only night that the two of them and their other brother, Brutus Junius, all performed together was, it was a benefit of, they did Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare, to raise money to put a statue of Shakespeare in Central Park, which is there to this day. And that, by sheer coincidence, the same night they did this, November 25th, 1864, was the same night that New York City was hit by its first terrorist attack. that Confederate agents, furious about the burning of Atlanta and what they consider other atrocities, tried to set all of Lower Manhattan on fire. And they set these little fires in hotels and buildings across the city and hoping it would, you know, turn to a much bigger conflagration. It failed, obviously. But Brutus Junius, John Wilkes, and Edwin were all performing at the Winter Garden Theater, and the building right next to theirs was one of those set on fire. And smoke actually started coming into the theater, and it was Edwin who calmed the crowd. They, you know, they stopped the production for a moment and then went back to what they were doing. But what I love is that when you go to Central Park, that statue for Shakespeare is still there. There is a mention of Edwin Booth. Of Edwin, no mention of John Wilkes, which is interesting because he was part of the fundraising effort. So again, you know, you find this one little story and then right. It just leads to all these other bigger stories.
Well, that little plaque needs to tell the whole story because the whole story is fascinating, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And I think, and what's interesting is there were the Winter Garden Theater and other buildings that were set on fire during this terrorist attack, none of them are marked. So it's really interesting how even that story has, which was a major incident, has pretty much gone overlooked.
Yes, I didn't know very much about that at all, if anything, the Confederate attacks on Manhattan.
Yeah, and they wanted to do this in cities across in northern cities across the Union, but it when this thing failed, a lot of them were rounded up, and it's just it's one of these little incidents that's
right.
out there.
You also note that Edwin voted for Abraham Lincoln, and Edwin referred to his brother John Wilkes Booth as a villain.
Yes, and they were close to some degree. They were a little competitive growing up because they were both actors and so forth, but they weren't distant. It was really only when they talked politics that they would, you know, start to argue and so forth. But I was curious whether, you know, I knew nothing about Edwin, so I wasn't sure if he was also a Confederate sympathizer or not, but he definitely very much so was on the Union side.
Mm-hmm. So you get wondering about all the other places that had to be discovered all over the United States, and where do you go but as far away from New York as you possibly could? You go to Hawaii, which is also a fascinating story.
That's right. I wanted to find stories from all different eras in our history, and obviously World War II, but we often think of that as really, you know, the battles and so forth that were fought overseas. It turns out that on December 7, 1941, a young Japanese pilot whose plane was hit crash-landed on this little tiny island called Niihau. It's the last of the inhabited islands on the Hawaiian chain, and it's actually privately owned. It was a group of Scottish ranchers who bought it from, and I always had trouble pronouncing the name of the king during that time. They bought it for $10,000 in gold. And so to this day, the descendants own it. And you're allowed to go on there. They run helicopter tours out, which is how I got to go. But most of the island is really off limits, and it's just for the villagers. But when this plane crash landed, there were 100 or so villagers who lived there and two who were of Japanese descent. And they immediately sided with the pilot and essentially using weapons that he had terrorized the villagers. And the villagers had actually gotten some of the top secret information that was in the pilot's plane, and so he was trying to get that back. But the reason it's significant is this story got out into the mainland press, and it's what, not, I won't say convinced more so than Pearl Harbor, but was a real factor in why many Americans felt they couldn't trust Japanese Americans, and unfairly so. And what I love about the story is because it has this sort of harsh, you know, element to it, but it ends on a positive note that it was a Japanese-American soldier who led the assault on Niihau to get that pilot. So, and he eventually joined the famed 442nd Regiment, which was an extraordinary group of Japanese Americans who served in the U.S. Army. They're the most highly decorated unit in American history and just real heroes of that war. And so, just the coda to it is it was actually a Japanese-American who led what was essentially the first ground invasion of the war to recapture this pilot and bring him to justice.
Mm. I also love the side story of how hard it was for you to get there. You set three alarms because there weren't many planes going over there very often, and you had to wait to get to that island.
Oh, yeah, and one of the things I really wanted to explore in the book is why are these stories forgotten? And why are there no plaques or markers there? Now, the Niihau one, you know, makes some sense because it's just so remote and so hard to get to. And what I wanted to emphasize was that, again, they run these tours constantly, but you're only allotted, you know, this one time slot. And so if a storm came in or if I were late or if other people didn't show up, they would have canceled it. And so I'd literally gone all the way across the country and then, you know, 3,000 more miles out to Niihau. So it was a very, you know, nerve-wracking experience, but I, you know, got on the helicopter, went out there, and it was really exciting. I mean, the trip alone was worth it, but then to be on that island and to see where this historic event happened was really a thrill.
All right, let's talk about the UFO sighting over Los Angeles, 1942, and the use of, this is a really bizarre story, the use of psychics.
You know, it's so funny because I set out a couple ground rules. One was no trespassing. I was very clear. I didn't want to go on anyone's private property and be respectful and so forth. The second thing was if someone owned a private home, you know, to get their permission to talk about it. We can talk about Richard Hart later. He's one of my favorite stories in the book and the home he had in Nebraska. But my third thing was, like, no weird stuff. Like, I'm not doing, like, Bigfoot sightings, things like that. This has got to be real history. But as I was researching the Niihau story and about Pearl Harbor, I learned about this night in February of 42 when Los Angeles thought it was under attack by UFOs. And the reason it was actually a significant story is the U.S. Army let loose a barrage of anti-aircraft fire onto what they, you know, what people just couldn't figure out what it was. And people died because of this. They were, you know, people had heart attacks. People were when they had the blackout, people crashed in their cars. So this incident, you know, had real consequences. And so it got me looking into all these sort of weird government stories, whether it was UFOs and so forth. But Jimmy Carter gave a speech where he was talking. Someone asked him, you know, you said you've seen a UFO, which Carter admitted to. And then he backtracked a little bit during this speech. But he said, you know, the one weird thing I did come across as president is I found out that we were using psychics to spy on the Soviets. And it was this whole thing that was taking place out of Fort Meade, Maryland, which became my site for the story, of using what they called remote viewing. So they would put this, you know, someone who claimed to be clairvoyant in a room, and they would be like, all right, here's some GPS coordinates. Tell us what's there. And they'd be like, okay, I see a satellite base, or I see a missile base. And then our satellites would, you know, double check and be like, that's actually, yeah, that was a missile base. So, you know, there were these weird instances where the stories kind of came true. But I just wanted to cover this element of American history that, you know, whether it was the CIA doing things with ESP or psychedelic drugs, there are these very bizarre elements in American history that are very quirky, but, you know, did have consequences.
So do you think the psychics ought to replace the NSA?
I am not going to comment on that for a variety of reasons. So I don't want to get angry letters from psychic or the NSA. And as I talk about in the book, I had a run-in with the FBI.
So I know.
I'm really trying to, you know, be on best behavior.
Well, you better mention what that was all about, as long as you brought it up.
So I really went to all 50 states to research these stories. And as I was going through Utah, my main story was about experiments that were taking place on American soldiers from a military base. And it was part of a larger thing on sort of medicine and scientific issues and how sometimes people have been guinea pigs unwittingly to these things. And as I was driving through Utah, I saw a sign for the Deseret Chemical Depot. And I'd read that depot was actually related and sort of a sister base to where I was headed to. So I thought, you know, I'll just pull over and take some pictures of the sign. The base I had read was decommissioned. So, and it's like 2 miles down in this valley. You can barely see it. So I'm just, you know, there's nobody around me. I'm out in the middle of like the Utah desert and I'm photographing this sign. And I think within like six pictures, you know, just a few seconds, this white car drove up. And I thought it was probably another tourist who's lost or a history buff or something. Out walks a soldier in his camis. He's military police. He's like, what are you doing out here? And I explained, I'm a historian. I'm going across the country, you know, photographing and writing about these sites. And he said, give me your camera. And I thought he was going to confiscate it. But he's like, I just want to see what pictures you would take. And I said, well, you know, the base has been closed. He's like, it's not closed. It's still active. Within about 5 minutes, six or seven SUVs, all military,
whoa,
were surrounding me. And it was getting really serious. So finally, the quote-unquote, the boss showed up. And he again sort of interrogated me, like, what are you doing here, and so forth. I explained it to him. He made me delete the photos I had taken. Were only of the sign. I mean, that was it. So I went off to do a whole other story about a skyjacking that was historically significant in Provo, Utah. So that became sort of my Utah story. And when I got home, after literally months on the road, there were a lot of odds and ends that needed to be taken care of, you know, bills to be paid, sure, all that stuff. And a friend of mine was applying to the FBI as an agent. And so he said, you're going to get a call from some of the other agents to do a reference. And I'm like, sure, of course. So I come home, and there is, sure enough, a card on my door of this, you know, agent, FBI, so forth. So I call him, and I said, hey, listen, you know, J. Michael is someone who worked with me. He's an extraordinary guy. You know, come. I'm happy to talk about him anytime. When's best for you? He's like, how about 30 minutes from now? And I said, sure. So two agents showed up, and I'm actually babbling like a fool about, like, hey, listen, if you guys did any background check on me, you might have seen that I'd, you know, is getting books on human experiments and all this stuff. That's just research. I'm not an anti-government conspiracy guy. So they sit down, and I say, once again, you know, Jay, he's a patriot. He's a real great guy. He was wonderful to work with. And they look at me, and they're like, who's Jay Michael? And I'm like, why are you guys here? I thought this was a reference thing. And I said, no, we want to know what you were doing photographing the Deseret Chemical Depot in Utah.
Oh, geez.
But they were following up on that. And I started telling them stories like the ones I've been telling you and others in the book as just proof of what I was doing. And by the end of it, they were like laughing. They were telling me some of their favorite history stories. And it turned out to be like a really kind of interesting moment. So I know I have an FBI file at this point, but I have a feeling that the worst in it, which you can probably tell already, is that, you know, he's incessantly chatty. But aside from that, it wasn't as scary as I thought it was going
to
be.
Well, it's a qualification for being on a talk show. You need to be chatty.
That's true, yeah.
Andrew Carroll is our guest this hour. His book, and a fascinating one it is Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to go there, that would be fine, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We want to tell you that this year is the 175th anniversary of John Muir's birth and the 50th anniversary of the Sierra Club John Muir chapter in Wisconsin. And they're celebrating with Andrew, actually, on Thursday, June 20th at 5:30. They're dedicating a plaque outside the North Hall dormitory room where wilderness defender, national parks advocate, and Sierra Club founder John Muir lived. So that's taking place this week. And Andrew will be there as well. He mentions John Muir in his book, Here Is Where. And you're invited to the event. More information on that is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Two phone calls for Andrew Carroll. Here Is Where is the book, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Andrew. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I do want to remind you, those of you who are political junkies, Jonathan Alter is with us tomorrow. I think Jonathan is a fine writer and has obviously looked very, very carefully at the second term and also what led up to the victory for the president in 2012. He looks at partisan bickering and the Tea Party in some detail and where the president went wrong in the first term, what he should have concentrated on. Jonathan has a new book. It is The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Jonathan Alter tomorrow at 10 o'clock. All right, to you now. Have you discovered little places that you think are very important in American history and they are really relatively unknown that you would like to tell Andrew about? Or do you have maybe he's discovered something that's in his book and can tell you more about something you've always wondered about that he wondered about, too, and now it's in the book. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Scott is our first caller from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
I'd like to put in my pitch for plaques, and I would recommend that in this country we emulate what the Brits do. And many, many decades ago, as a young hippie backpacker, I was in London, and they call them the blue plaques. They're blue and white, and And it seems like every time you turn around, you see another one of these things on a building. Like, you know, this was the birthplace of Jeremy Bentham, or this is where David Copperfield lived when he was writing David Copperfield, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite was in the old St. Bartholomew's, St. Bart's Hospital in London. They had a plaque that said, on this spot, Sherlock Holmes first spoke the words to Dr. Watson, "You've been in Afghanistan, I perceive." And the fact that they would put up a plaque where two fictional characters met, I think just is so cool.
I love that. And I've seen those blue plaques as well. And, you know, Egypt, of all countries, is actually one of the best on historic markers.
Really?
And they actually have a whole automated system, too, that I wish we did here. Well, we probably do have here with apps and so forth. But, yeah, the blue plaques throughout Great Britain are wonderful. And, Scott, you reminded me just of a quick story. My mom was backpacking after college, and she's in her 80s now. But she was a young, you know, just in her 20s. And it turns out that my grandfather was friends with Alexander Fleming, the discoverer of penicillin. And I was telling my mom about a story in Peoria, which I'll go into more detail later, where penicillin was actually manufactured. It really wasn't so much in England. But when I was telling her this, she's like, "Oh, yeah, when I was in London, I had lunch with Fleming." And I'm like, "You had lunch with the inventor of penicillin?" And I was like, "You never told me this before." And she said, "You never asked." And it is just how, like, within our own families, we have these amazing connections to history. You know, it could be someone who was in the Civil Rights Movement or with the Peace Corps or, you know, just all sorts of different aspects of American history that we don't even realize. So, Scott, when you mentioned the backpacking through London, that reminded me of my mom having, you know, lunch one day with Alexander Fleming and his wife while she was doing the same thing.
Hmm.
Sadly, the blue plaques have been are in hiatus right now because of budget cutbacks, I read. But I also saw that they're going to be coming back as soon as possible. I think people really, really sort of cherish that idea, and so do I. So
mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to reading your book. It sounds like it's really great.
Yeah,
thanks
I think
so much.
You'll love it. You're
Thank
the kind
you
of guy
so
who would like it. Thanks, Scott. As long as we're talking about adventures, let's tell the story of this really, you know, remarkable woman, and I like the way you write this chapter because you don't really know she's a woman right off the bat. J.A. Archibald, climbing Pikes Peak.
That's right. And she, one of my other criterion was that each story had to have national significance. So, I write, for example, about a woman named Adina de Zavala who barricaded herself inside the Alamo. This is back in like 1908 when developers were going to tear down most of it and put hotels up. And we think of how, you know, sacred that site is to Texans today and to many people, that, you know, it was just going to be demolished for developers. And so she literally barricaded herself out. So in some ways it's a Texas story, but she's significant because she was at the forefront of the preservation movement throughout the United States. And similar with J.A. Archibald, that although it's very much a Colorado story because she was the first woman to climb Pike's Peak, Pike himself couldn't get up to the top, and others had done so since, but she was the first woman. I wanted to kind of – she went by the initials J.A. Archibald, so I just – you know, kept all the pronouns, you know, gender specific out of it. And sure enough, when my editor and others read this, everyone sort of assumed that I was writing about this man.
Yes.
But it was really this phenomenal woman. And she was, part of the early suffrage movement, was proving that women could do anything that men could do. And the one thing that really irked her fellow travelers, more so than the fact that they're like, "Why is this woman coming along with us?" But that she was wearing pantaloons, and they were really aghast at that. So, there are all these little elements to it that I thought were really unique and interesting. But I took the train up. When I did the story, because I went to the summit myself, they have this little locomotive that goes to the top. But she did it by foot, and it's a real tough climb, and she was an extraordinary individual.
I bet that's quite a train ride, isn't it, Andrew?
Well, it's very slow, so it's like, you know, it's one of these incline things, and it's a fair amount of a ride to get up there, but it was definitely worth it. And what's interesting, and this is not meant to be a gotcha kind of thing, and no part of this book is meant in any way to be like, oh, you know, how come the local historical society hasn't done something? You know, Scott just said, as with in England, here too in the States, we don't have the funding to like, I'm actually funding the John Muir Marker. I'm paying for that with royalties from the book.
But you are? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's I'm doing this across the country. There are a lot of places where, you know, we put up at the Marriott, which is my kickoff here in Washington, D.C., a plaque for where Langston Hughes was discovered. He was a young busboy,
yes.
And the poet Vachel Lindsay was there, and Langston Hughes gave him three of his poems as he was serving him, you know, and eventually Lindsay was like, boy, this is a remarkable young poet, and really spread the word, and so that's how Langston Hughes was discovered. So we put up a plaque there to kind of kick off the whole trip. But, you know, that's so as you go up to Pikes Peak on this train, there's no mention of Julia Archibald Holmes. And it's really remarkable. So I want to work with them to put a plaque up at the summit in her honor.
Very nice. Susan is next in Oregon. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I am assuming you know about the school where John Muir taught, which is just west of Oregon. And I'm wondering if there might be a plaque.
I don't know about that. Can you give me more details? Because this is what I love about the project, is people sharing, you know, stories and sites, you know, as well.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a building that's now it's turned into a house, and somebody lives there, but it was the school where John Muir taught, and the stories I've heard is that he used to walk from the school into the University of Wisconsin, which is a good walk. I would think that's probably easily a 10 or 15 mile walk.
Wow.
And I think he only taught there a couple of years. I think that I don't know much of the history, but I think it was in the early days when he was attending the university. It's located west of Oregon on it's the intersection of Jefferson Street, which becomes Highway CC, and let me think now just for a minute. Jefferson and Storytown Road.
Okay.
I'm writing all this down.
In the community around here, it's pretty well known, but as I said, I don't think there's any plaque there at all. There might be a plaque saying that it was a one-room schoolhouse at one time.
But not that John Muir taught there.
No, it sounds like.
I'm working with the local Sierra Club. That's just been wonderful. It's the Sierra Club based in Madison, and they've just been phenomenal, and they're really the ones who have helped organize this whole event on Thursday night, Thursday early evening. And so I'll check with them as well, because they may know about that too and give you more details.
Yeah.
Again, this is what I love about this project, is when people, you know, say, hey, there's a site you should know about, and, you know, odds are I've never heard of it.
Right. Well, there's so many sites, right? You can't know everything about everything, always.
Well, you know, and that's what's surprising the most, is I wanted to tell the American story beginning with the first Paleo-Indians who were here some 14,000, 15,000 years ago. And I found a story in Paisley, Oregon, that was the first DNA discovered in America, the oldest DNA discovered in America. And then all these different eras, the Spanish explorers, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, you know, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Spanish influenza, you know, all these different things. And, you know, I was able to track down unmarked sites related to every single one of them. And it really is remarkable what's still out there.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the less than happy and events that took place that we should be ashamed of, actually, because it's important to know this. The Rock Springs, Wyoming, the Union Pacific bringing in immigrants from all over, speaking all languages, a lot of Chinese. This is a fascinating story because there really was a massacre here. There was the enactment of the Chinese Exclusion Act, and you went there.
I did, yes. As you said, it's in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and there was a massacre that occurred in 1885. It was there was a community of Chinese immigrants who were living in Rock Springs. And they were working in the mines, and one day they walked, some other miners walked into their quote-unquote their room where they were working and said, this is our room, we're mining here. The Chinese said, no, this is ours. And it was just the supervisor had made a mistake and double-booked where they were both supposed to be working. And fists, you know, were flown, and then suddenly people were bringing out pickaxes and stuff like that and turned into this riot.
Mm.
And the town ganged up on the entire Chinese community and killed several dozen of them. The rest were sent fleeing out in the freezing, you know, kind of wilderness, and some perished out there as well. And finally, American troops were brought in to quell the rioting and to bring the Chinese back and so forth. And they actually stayed there for some time to keep calm. And you know, this is the worst massacre of immigrants in American history. And I will say that working with the Rock Springs Historical Society, they are going to put up a marker about this. They think that, you know, it's absolutely appropriate for us to do this. And you did say appropriately that there are darker elements that are covered in the book. I have, you know, stories about slavery and stories, mm-hmm. as I said, about human experiments on people and so forth. What I liked about the Rock Springs story is that it did end on a positive note. There was a gentleman out there named Bob Nelson who was my guide and who works with his head of the Historical Society. And I said to him, you know, this is just such a terrible story and such a dark part of our past. Did any good come out of it? And he said, you know, years later, when they were setting up, and again, this is sort of how these stories are interconnected, the internment camps to place Japanese Americans, the government came to Rock Springs and said, we're going to put up an internment camp. And we said, no. We've done this before, and we will not be a part of this. And it was because of they learned from their history. And so it's one of the things I wanted to emphasize is, you know, like I focus on a slave named Ona Judge, and I don't want to give away the reveal here because I think it's a really powerful story.
Yes, it is.
But, you know, so obviously this is, you know, one of the worst aspects of our history. But she was such a heroic figure. She was one of the earliest pioneers, sort of without even meaning to be, of the Underground Railroad. And she defied the most powerful slave master in the United States. And she went up to New Hampshire, and when you think of their motto, live free or die, she embodies that to me more than anyone I've ever come across. So, you know, I wanted, in focusing on these, you know, harsher aspects of our history, I wanted to also pinpoint the courage, the resilience, the sacrifice of so many incredible Americans.
Mm-hmm. Irene Morgan. We know Rosa Parks. We don't know Irene Morgan.
That's right. And in fact, when I talk, you know, to different groups across the country, I'll start off by saying, you know, we all know the story of the very brave African-American woman who refused to give up her seat on a bus. It was really a pivotal moment in the civil rights movement. It led to a Supreme Court case. And of course, her name is, and then you'll hear muttering in the audience like Rosa Parks. I'm like, nope, Irene Morgan. 11 years before Rosa Parks, withstood and went to jail for what she did. Irene Morgan did the exact same thing, and this happened in 1944. And the reason it didn't get more, it didn't get more play is because she fought back. She, when the deputies came on the bus to take her off, I'll be very delicate in how I phrase this, she kicked one of the sheriffs in a very sensitive place.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds sort of humorous, but in a way, and she's an incredible figure. The fact that Rosa Parks went peacefully really is what made her more of a spotlight. And in fact, even before Rosa Parks, 9 months earlier, on the exact same bus route, a 15-year-old girl named Claudette Colvin also did the exact same thing, refused to give up her seat. She was arrested. She almost became the focus of this part of the civil rights movement, but then it was discovered that she was pregnant. And the NAACP didn't want someone, 15 years old and pregnant, serving as sort of the face of the movement. So Rosa Parks was, turned out to be that heroine that they were looking for. And one side comment, Rosa Parks always was very lamented the fact that she was called this sort of this elderly woman. She's like, I was 40 years old. I wasn't that old. But everyone thought I was like this spinstress or something. And she's like, I wasn't. I was just, I was tired of being told what to do.
Yeah. Our phone number, please join the conversation if you'd like. Andrew Carroll is our guest this hour. And Andrew is the author of a really fascinating book, Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. He traveled all over the country. This idea was sparked when he visited the spot where Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert, was saved by the brother of Lincoln's assassin, and it got him thinking, what about all the other places that nobody knows about? So he went, and this is a huge thing, 4 years, 50 states, traveled all over, and has compiled a book of important stories, very important stories. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also go to our Facebook page where there is more information about the June 20th event dedicating this plaque where John Muir got his great inspiration. It's at UW-Madison. All right. Well, I hope you'll join us, more of you. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Andrew Carroll, our guest. The book is Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. And we had an email, Jeff emailing, saying that the John Muir hand-whittled alarm clock, and I didn't even know he invented this, automatic page-turner, is in the State Historical Society main floor of the UW campus in Madison. You'll have to see that when you're there, I guess.
You know, one of the things I loved about reading about Muir is that he was this amazing inventor, and there was almost this Looney Tunes, Bugs Bunny-ish kind of element to some of his inventions. He invented a bed that, when the alarm went off, flipped up so they would literally push him out of the bed at a certain time.
That's a
great
idea.
And it just reminds me of these, like, Wile E. Coyote kind of, like, Rube Goldberg devices. And he did these amazing things, and he was such an incredible character.
Oh, I could use a bed like that.
Yeah.
That's really a good idea, isn't it? That's a good idea. You do say in the book, and I imagine that it would have to be the case, after traveling to some pretty darn remote areas, you not only met some fascinating characters, but you really had to depend on the kindness of strangers, didn't you?
It really, you know, one of the questions I'm asked most is, like, how do you come across these ideas? You know, the very nature of the fact that they're sort of forgotten, that they're unmarked, lends itself to the fact that, well, how does one even, you know, discover them? And I'd alluded earlier to, you know, private homes that are significant. And one of my favorite stories is about a gentleman named Richard Hart. And he was one of the top prohibition agents in the 1920s. He was famous for busting up stills and for catching bootleggers across the country. More famous, well, Elliot Ness came later. But he really was this very well-known figure. His real name, and many people didn't know this, was Vincenzo Capone. He was Al Capone's older brother. And of all the brothers, pretty much the entire family went into crime, and Richard was the one who went on the straight and narrow. And so I went to the little house in Homer, Nebraska, where he had lived, and so forth. And actually, on my way there, I was driving up from St. Louis, I got pulled over by a state trooper because I was speeding. And he said, "Why did you know? Hey, do you know how fast you're going?" And I said, "I had no idea." He's like, "You're going 90 something." And I apologized. I said, "Listen, I'm kind of going across country." And this was the dumbest answer I could have given. But I said, "And I just sort of zone out. I'm not paying attention." So he of course, gave me a ticket. He was furious. He said, "Listen, just put on your cruise control and don't even think about it." So, honest to goodness, I still have the ticket. On the back of it, a few moments later, I wrote, "Cruise control inventor, ? And I was curious, well, you know, it's not the most significant, you know, invention in American history, but we've all either used it or we, of course, know about it. And so while I was on the road, I did some research, and I ended up finding the inventor's daughter, and Margie Teeter. And her father, Ralph, was this brilliant engineer, and he could build, and this was back when cars were a lot simpler, a full-size automobile at the age of 12.
Ooh.
What makes him even more remarkable is that he was completely blind. And he had, you know, just a great grasp of mechanics, and he could do it all by just by hand. And so the one thing he couldn't do was drive himself, for obvious reasons. So his lawyer was driving him around one day and had this very annoying sort of stop-and-go, lurching back-and-forth driving style that drove Teeter crazy. So he went down to his basement laboratory and built the cruise control, and then he sold it, I think, first to Cadillac and a few other car companies, and they all loved it. And that's how cruise control came to be, because of this blind inventor. But if that police officer hadn't stopped you know, it was just a serendipitous moment that led to this greater discovery.
I hope that police officer knows what you did with all that. Oh, darn.
I don't think he does. I don't think he wants to. He was pretty upset, and legitimately so.
Right.
But it was just dumb on my part, and I certainly don't recommend it.
Yeah, you learned your lesson.
I learned my
lesson. Right, good. All right, Dorothy in Marshfield. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
You were talking a little bit earlier about women's right to vote, and that reminded me of a family anecdote that I treasure. My grandmother was pregnant in 1920, and she was expecting a baby in the first week of November. And as an immigrant who had earned her citizenship by marrying an American citizen, she was very thrilled about being a citizen and was really looking forward to voting. And I didn't find this out until 75 years later, but she voted by absentee ballot in that first election when in 1920 when women could vote for president.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just delighted with that story. And unfortunately, I learned about it so late that my grandmother was already gone.
Yes.
But I started asking other people if they have anecdotes like that in their families. And I'm having a really hard time following up and finding more such stories because the generations are past, you know.
Mm-hmm. I bet Andrew can give you some advice. Can you, Andrew?
Yeah, there's someone who you should know about, and she's very easy to find on the Internet. Her name is Megan Smolenyak.
What?
Actually, her real name is Megan Smolenyak. She married a very, very distant cousin who happened to have the same last name, and she's a genealogist. She was responsible for the show on NBC, Who Do You Think You Are, which was they get celebrities and kind of track back their genealogy.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And she is, if you go to our website, hereiswhere.org, which links to our Facebook page, Megan is one of my likes and so forth, but she is so good about, she has all sorts of information on the Internet about getting these stories out of family members and so forth. And in fact, the last chapter of the book is my coming home to Washington, which is where I was actually...
Oh, that's who she is.
I was born and raised here. And Megan and I went around Washington, because she lived here as well, kind of finding unmarked sites. And she came up with what's really the ultimate story of the book, of the former slave who built the Statue of Freedom above the Capitol. There's one little side story is Megan and I were driving past Blair House, which has like 11 markers on it, so it's well marked. But my favorite story that's not marked, and it never will be, is President Boris Yeltsin, who was president of Russia at the time, came to visit President Clinton. And Blair House, of course, is where foreign dignitaries and leaders stay when they're visiting the White House. At like 3 in the morning, Yeltsin somehow slipped past his security detail, was completely hammered, just plastered out of his mind, and was on Pennsylvania Avenue in his underwear trying to hail a taxi because he wanted some pizza. And it was our Secret Service agents who saw him first and really pushed him back into Blair House, because this would have been an international incident if anyone had photographed this. And I thought, again, when I first heard this, like, this just can't be true. Well, it was President Clinton himself who told the story in a book by Taylor Branch. I think it was called The White House Diaries. And Branch said to President Clinton, "How did you guys resolve this?" He's like, "Well, we got him a pizza." So it, it all worked out in the end. But it's just, it was just, even in your own little home, you know, wherever you live, there are these great stories all around us, and it's just a question of finding them.
Right. Thanks, Dorothy, for the call. Mitch in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
I have a question. Have you ever been to Bellingham, Washington?
I have.
A wonderful.
But tell me if there's a story that I should know about.
Yeah, the interesting story was we had booked a hostel there outside of Bellingham and had no idea what we were soon to see. On the site was a former 1960s-era Cold War tower, minus the dish on top, of course. So that was just fascinating. I actually crawled up the tower and looked at it and... thought back to, you know, the days of when we were monitoring Russia.
That is great. You know, I do actually a couple stories on the Cold War. There's one in particular about during the Bay of Pigs, there was an American pilot who was shot down over Cuba, and the orders from the military, we were obviously helping, you know, the Cuban exiles who were trying to take over and replace Castro. But at first we were told that the Americans were only going to provide help with repairing the planes and so forth. But eventually they started flying missions, and one of them got shot down, and Castro held his body. He was killed, tragically. Castro held this pilot's body for 18 years as a kind of war trophy, and then eventually got it back to the family. And the, you know, sort of the harsh code of that story is that Castro charged the family $30,000 for refrigeration costs.
Oh my gosh.
Which, of course, they did not pay, and they got the body. It was actually the daughter who told me the story, and so she's like, "We got my father's body back." But it's another just quick thing. I talk about Hart Island, which is the largest potter's field in America. It's this extraordinary little island in the Long Island Sound outside of Manhattan, and one of the things on the island, along with all, you know, again, being the largest potter's field, was a Nike missile silo base. And it's just the history of this little tiny, it's like, you know, just a couple, about 100 acres, is really incredible.
Let's mention a couple people we ought to know about and we don't. The scientist, I think you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but let's give some time to the scientist who probably saved more lives in the 20th century with his vaccines than anyone else, but virtually unknown.
It's just remarkable. Maurice Hilleman, he invented about, I don't know, 6 or 7 of the 14 vaccines that most of us will get in life. And his first great discovery was he found the vaccine for mumps, and he actually used his little daughter's, she came down with it, and it was using a scraping from her throat that he invented the vaccine. It's still called the Gerald Lynn mumps vaccine.
Oh.
And he went on to invent several others, especially the rubella and so forth, that has just saved millions of lives across the country. What's incredible about his story is that I went to Miles City, Montana, which is where he was born. It's a very small town. And as I'm going down the main road, there is like a historical marker over every single house. I'd never seen anything like it, but it's more like this was built by the architect so-and-so, so-and-so. Here lived the dentist, so-and-so. So I get to Maurice Hilleman's house, no marker. And it's within a stone's throw of the Historical Society. And I went in and I was like, hey, I'm doing research on Maurice Hilleman. They're like, we have no idea who you're talking about. And he's not just one of the most significant people to come out of Montana, but out of the United States. Again, he's saved millions of lives all over the world. So we are now talking with them about working. And it gets to this issue of, so how does someone like that get overlooked? It just turned out that Hilleman was very modest. And unlike many scientists who name their vaccines after themselves, he wouldn't do it. Even Gerald Lynn, it wasn't the Gerald Lynn Hilleman vaccine. It was just the Gerald Lynn mumps vaccine. So it's, that's one of the things that he, among scientists, he's well known. But within the general public, he's been completely forgotten.
Oh, I'm glad you're bringing him back to life in that regard. That's
absolutely
good. Yeah. Carolyn in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. Your talk about Long Island reminded me that in a recent book club meeting, we were talking about the postmistress, and there's a character there who looks out over the ocean to look for enemy subs. Back in the mid-40s, I was out in my rowboat off our creek, Phoenix Creek in Santa Maria, Long Island, and I found a German uniform in the swampy place. Of course, I brought it home, and the Coast Guard came, and it was all very exciting. Huh. But thank you for this wonderful program.
Wow, and what did you do with the uniform?
Oh, the Coast Guard took it.
They took it, oh, okay.
Or the police, I don't remember. I was pretty young.
That's quite a story.
It is quite a story. Imagine finding that as a kid. Thanks, Caroline, for the call. Dee in Madison says, I work at John Muir Elementary School in Madison. In our main office, a beautiful wall carving that takes up the entire wall. It depicts John Muir in his natural environment teaching a group of children, and the models for the children were actually Muir students at the time.
Wow.
That's nice.
Yeah, and I'm hoping along with the plaque we're putting up, the Sierra Club found this beautiful, beautiful rendering of John Muir, and it was by an artist, I think, from Wisconsin, and I'm hoping that we're going to put that up as well, because it really gives, it's just such a wonderful portrait of him, too.
Nice. We should also talk about, because it's interesting how people can do so much good and then be such weirdos and racists, Madison Grant.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because I was just thinking with the story of, with preservationists and conservationists, Madison Grant is the reason why the redwoods were saved.
Really?
He, again, there was this whole movement early in the 1900s to just wipe out the redwoods, use them for furniture and all sorts of different things, and he almost single-handedly led the fight to preserve them. And when you go to the redwoods, the main redwoods forest in Northern California, there's a founder's plaque, and it mentions Madison Grant. Someone wrote to the head of the California Department of Parks saying you've got to remove that plaque, that Madison Grant's name should not be put anywhere. And in this case, I think that person had a legitimate argument, because Madison Grant was the worst eugenicist of the early 1900s. So along with wanting to save the redwoods, he was a complete white supremacist and just a terrible, terrible human being. And the Nazis actually were reading his material as they were forming their own views on eugenics. And Hitler called Madison Grant's book, The Passing of the Great Race, his Bible. And so this is one of the things where, I do a story on Madison Grant, the environmentalist, and then it's sort of like, why has he been forgotten?
Right.
And in this case, it's one of those things where it's almost a good thing that he was really just this horrible person. I don't want to end on a negative note.
No.
So many of the people who I focus are like these great pioneers and inventors, and one of my favorites, I just want to mention quickly, is Philo Farnsworth. And he was the 14-year-old farm boy who invented electronic television.
Right. Isn't that amazing? Because he saw a pattern in the field or something?
That's right. Yeah, he was you know, on his tractor, going back and forth. And a lot of people have been talking about television, this just the general idea of getting one image, you know, sort of to another area. But he's the one who figured it out. And what's interesting is that I really focus on the farm in Rigby, Idaho, where he had his epiphany. But just recently, I went to the Los Angeles apartment building where he did his first experiments. He was about 20 at this time. And there's no plaque or marker there either. And it was great because I met the family who was living there. And they're like, we had no idea that, you know, this, the inventor of television was right here. So that's the exciting part of this project, is when I go to these places and even the people who live there are like, we didn't know.
Yeah, well, that's why you exist, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it immensely. I'll bet he's in high demand on the Let's Have Lunch with Andrew circuit, or invite him to our party. Here Is Where is the name of the book, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. Just a reminder that this Thursday, June 20th, is the celebration marking the spot where he had his epiphany, John Muir, and you're invited, 5:30 to 7, UW-Madison's North Hall. So that's that. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and help from KP Whaley, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Just a reminder, during this time period tomorrow, Jonathan Alter will be with us, written a really fascinating book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Great conversations ahead.